Well, hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us this afternoon on this innovation panel. We're really excited to be talking with you today, and I feel like we've put together a really interesting panel of experts who've been in this industry and been in the Valley for a long time at both really, you know, large companies like LinkedIn and Facebook, eBay, and so forth, but also at some smaller companies and startups. And so I think they have a wide range of experiences with their own teams trying to understand what is it that drives product innovation? What are the things that lead to successful innovation? What processes work and what fails? What are some of the myths that I think have really become stumbling blocks for a lot of companies that are pursuing this? So I'm going to start with a brief introduction of who everyone is. Very briefly, my name is Larry Cornett. I'm an innovation consultant. I primarily work with startups and a few larger companies, Fortune 500 companies, but really helping people kind of work on their product and business strategy, and specifically looking at how can they bring an innovative product or service to the market. I've been in the Valley for about 18 years, really doing a lot of design, some development, and looking at consumer products at places like Apple Computer, eBay, and IBM. Most recently, I was the vice president of consumer products for Yahoo Search until they made the decision to outsource that to Bing, and so here I am today. So let me go ahead and introduce the rest of the panel. Kate Aronowitz is the head of design at Facebook, and I'll let Kate say a few words about who she is.
Sure. Hi. Thanks for having me. So I currently manage the design and user experience team at Facebook, which includes front-end engineering, user research, content, and design. Previously, I got my start in actually fashion design many years ago, and then moved to the Valley about 10 years ago, where I started web design at eBay. And then also went on to LinkedIn, where we worked to build the design and research team there. Personally, I'm interested in the panel because I think one of the reasons I got into design was just the fascination with new ways of looking at very common items and common objects, and being interested in how people use everyday things or objects or technology and taking a new spin on them. And I've had lots of experience with companies and trying to put innovation in their process.
Thanks, Kate. So let me introduce Adam Nash, who's currently at Greylock Partners. But Adam, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. So my name is Adam Nash. I am joining Greylock in October. Most recently, I was the vice president of product at LinkedIn, where I was responsible for search and cloud features, as well as platform and mobile. Obviously, very excited about all those areas. If I have to think about the thing that I'm most proud of, though, at LinkedIn, it's really my contribution to helping build up the innovation culture there, which culminated the last few years with the monthly hack days, LinkedIn Labs, and a lot of things that have become real staples to the engineering culture at that company. So this is a topic I'm obviously very passionate about. As you can tell from my language, I actually believe it's a little bit more of a culture issue for an organization more than anything else. But that's why I love high-tech startups. That's why I love technology, because it takes great people coming together in interesting ways to make great software.
Great. Thanks, Adam. And finally, let me introduce Luke Rabluski. And I think Luke has been in a really interesting situation where he's been at some pretty large companies, if you look at Yahoo and eBay, but most recently was the co-founder of a startup that was acquired by Twitter. And I'll let Luke tell his story.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. So thanks for having me as well. As Larry mentioned, the past year I was in a three-person, then down to a two-person startup, working on a new consumer product that was acquired by Twitter a little over a month ago, and just jumping into my next startup now. So I'm kind of in that mindset recently. But prior to that, I spent a number of years at Yahoo, and I actually had a small independent team of designers and developers. We called ourselves the product ideation team. Not to be confused with innovation, but our charter was really looking forward about, I don't know, two product releases or so into the future on a lot of Yahoo's major products and building very real, very actionable prototypes, designs, and experiences that the whole company could start actually interacting with. So like Adam, I'm revealing a little bit of my bias towards this topic of innovation because I believe it's very much a hands-on creation and building activity rather than a talking and planning and strategizing activity.
Great. Thanks, Luke. So I'm going to dive into a couple of questions that I think will really help set the context for this and just to get the panelists' opinions on kind of the broader strokes of what is innovation and what does successful innovation look like. So I'm going to go ahead and I'll start with Kate again. Kate, can you just give us a sense of what do you think innovation is? How would you define it? And why do you think organizations should care?
Sure. So I think I'll join with the other guys in saying that I think a lot of it has to do with culture. I'll focus in particular on like Facebook, where we have a very strong company culture towards rapid iteration, being very comfortable with iteration, being comfortable with taking risks, being comfortable with expressing your ideas and your thoughts. And I think that that really does start to drive some innovation. Can you move on to Adam for a second?
Sure. Adam, do you want to give us kind of your viewpoint on how you would define it? It sounds like you gave us a bit of a hint in your introduction, but would love to hear more about it.
Yeah, I think Kate and I think about this similarly. I mean, one of the great things about Facebook, as well as companies like LinkedIn and others that have made this a part of their culture, is I think what you realize about innovation is it is a culture issue. I used to talk about when I kick off Hackdays, but really the magic of Hackdays is not about a contest. It's not about prizes. It's not about having a trophy list of interesting ideas. It's about people inspiring each other. I used to talk a lot about inspiration, emotion. What makes this generation of social software and consumer software different than the generations that came before us is that we finally have accepted that our customers, our consumers, and our engineers and designers, we're human beings. We have emotions. We have passions. Engagement is really about how we engage through software with other human beings about ideas and topics that are passionate to us. And believe it or not, I think that innovation comes from that same type of engagement within an organization and company. When an engineer gets up and experimenting with Node.js synchronizes music across 20 different machines in a couple hours, he doesn't just show off a neat trick. He doesn't just show off that he has a big brain. He inspires hundreds of other people to think about what could they do with that technology? What could they do with a couple hours of time? And so I think that as I've migrated through different companies, whether it was Apple or eBay or LinkedIn, and now into my role in venture, the thing I've become most appreciative of is that it's emotion, it's that inspiration, it's that culture that drives innovation. It's not a formal process. It's not a budget. It's not a specific contest. It's really about how do you get people in the habit of rapidly inspiring each other to do even more, to do things that they didn't even think were possible yesterday. So that's what I'm really passionate about.
Great. Luke, how about giving us your thoughts on innovation?
Sure. So I actually have a little bit of a different take on these things. I think the creation part is a very necessary way to work through ideas, but when it really comes down to it, everybody makes things all the time. Even companies that aren't really quote-unquote innovative are constantly churning out new products and new features and shipping things. Some of them get pretty stagnant and don't, and that's sort of a worst-case scenario when you're not doing anything. At that point, everything sort of stalls. But the more interesting thing to me about innovation in a very broad, high-level sense of the term is the way it's actually an act of destruction rather than creation. Because to do something very innovative, at least the stuff that, you know, the market and tech press lauds as very innovative, you have to destroy some piece of who you are or what you've been doing previously. And I think that's actually the very, very hard part, right? You have to put yourself into a state of a lot of discomfort and ultimately kind of forget about the things that you thought that you know work, right? Because that's, you're not going to disrupt yourself by doing the things you're already comfortable with. You're not going to come up with something really, really innovative by just sticking to the same game plan or floor plan that you had earlier. And so this destructive aspect of real large-scale, meaningful innovation is the part that I think is a very big stumbling block for people. And the way you get there, I think, is still through this process of creation and hands-on work.
But yeah, cool.
I think that seems to be a larger issue.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, you know, one other point that I want to make, and I made this point, I guess a few weeks ago, and it made some people uncomfortable, is that I think it's very easy to be attracted to innovation and kind of envision the brainstorming process, the creative process, invention, and so forth. And I think that's really where a lot of companies kind of get led astray. You know, I think they innovate for the sake of innovating. They put teams together to do it. and they forget what they're really trying to accomplish. So I think if you're going to define what is innovation, what is successful innovation, I think it really is the goal-driven creation of a new product, service, or process that actually has value, that is valuable enough that the intended market adopts it. You know, I think if you have innovation without these goals, without some type of business strategy, you're really just, you know, having fun. You're experimenting. It's almost art in some sense.
Well, let me double down on that for a second when you say, you know, there's a clear goal. I think the challenge when it really is, and again, I'm pushing things that are highly innovative in retrospect, right? At the beginning, there isn't necessarily such a clear goal or outcome because this stuff is new and unproven. And I think that's where it gets challenging, right?
Yeah, I would
agree. If it was a really clearly stated goal and value, then everybody would just get on board and you'd do it.
Absolutely.
Instead, it's an unknown. And you got half the organization, if not more, saying, well, I don't know. So things really stall.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, don't get me wrong in saying that there's actually a more formal kind of business strategy or goal that is driving the process. But I think even the wildest inventor who's sitting in the garage creating something is creating it for a reason. There's something that they've experienced that they're not happy with, or something that they would like to be capable of doing, or a friend, and they're inspired to create something to satisfy that need. So I think as loosely as it's defined, I think there is some goal that is driving innovation that actually ends up being useful.
Absolutely. Just that goal may be very counter to the primary way an organization makes money,
yeah,
which is
absolutely
where the discomfort comes in, right? And where the problems show up.
So let me go ahead and touch a little bit on this concept of being uncomfortable, because I think if you look at a lot of organizations, they all claim that they want to be innovative. And many organizations, especially larger corporations, have innovation processes, and yet they seem to struggle. There's very few companies that I think you can point your finger at and say, wow, that's a very successful, innovative company. Whereas it seems that, especially in the Valley, we see a lot of startups that are doing pretty amazing things with very small resources. So I'd like to get the perspective of the panel on this, because you've been at the smaller companies and the larger companies. You've seen a lot of this. And why do you think they're struggling so much to be successful? Kate?
I don't want to repeat myself. I think a lot of it goes back to values and stuff. Speaking personally from the two products that I'm thinking about in particular with Facebook, where I think innovation was a goal, and it wasn't just innovate for the sake of innovation, but it was something that we really thought that we could do better on, was our Messages product that we released last year, and then our recent timeline announcement. And again, at the company, this was a pretty large group of people working on each product, and we all just knew that at the end of the day that we could do much better than what was out there at the in the market, and we weren't afraid to throw away a lot of work. I think sometimes people just get fascinated with the new, and you could say something's an innovative idea, and you can fall in love with your ideas and switch it out to market. I mean, that may be why some of the smaller companies are failing. Just because something's new doesn't mean it's going to be successful. With the recent timeline announcement, again, it hasn't been live yet for people, so it's not, we still need to get a lot of feedback on it. But there were three major, major different approaches that were completely built and torn down before we felt comfortable with it. And I think internally, when we launched both Messages and Timeline, I think you can kind of gut check, does everybody feel comfortable, but are you being pushed out of your comfort zone just a bit? You know, I think if you play things safe, you probably won't be able to make much of a leap forward. And certainly this can bite you with users, as we've seen, as well with like homepages that we made last week. So, again, I think it goes down to values and not being afraid to tear down your work and throw it out, not just be fascinated with something because it's innovative, but look at the need that it's truly trying to solve.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Kate. It's funny. I don't think it's a coincidence that everyone on this panel has some sort of design or HCI background in them. I feel like I've lived in two worlds, right? I got to, exercise out my, right brain on the design and HCI background, and then I did the unthinkable and actually went to business school and spent some time with the left brain folks. But I'll tell you, I think large organizations have a problem because there's a natural aversion that a lot of managers and executives have to a truly distributed system. It's ironic. We're in an industry where we build distributed software for a living. And yet we're really uncomfortable in many, many organizations with a distributed process, which involves empowering individual designers and engineers to not just come up with inspiring ideas, but actually pursue them. It's a funny form of risk aversion. And I think ironically, I had the benefit in business school spending time with Clay Christensen on kind of the theories of disruption and the innovator's dilemma. And I'll tell you that it's never because the managers are bad at what they're doing. These executives at large companies are smart, and it's not like they don't have passion. In a weird way, it's because they manage things too efficiently from a traditional standpoint. And that risk of wasted resource, that risk that you have some of your best people not working on your most important projects. Most often, your most important projects are very incremental. They will move the needle on metrics. They will move the needle on revenue. But they're not where the next 5 to 10 years are going to come from. And so I think one of the challenges that large organizations have is, ironically, that from traditional measures, they're very well run. They're very efficient. But innovation isn't efficient. It's messy. You go down paths that are dead end. You learn from mistakes. And I think the best Web 2.0 companies are finding ways to basically nurture people taking those risks, working on those projects with the ample resources they have. And fortunately, a few of those companies have the resources to spend that time and money and the belief that we'll do it better this time.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think what I've seen, you know, in my own experience at some of these larger corporations where we had a process in place is that there really wasn't a willingness, you know, to take a big risk and give it time. I think there is a sense of urgency, obviously, when someone is investing in an innovation process and they expect to see returns. And the problem is with a really big disruptive innovation, you're not going to see immediate returns. You know, immediately what it might actually do is hurt product metrics. I mean, we often would see that. And unfortunately, if there's a leader at the top who doesn't feel comfortable waiting for that to see what's going to happen as that product evolves, they pull the plug. You know, they don't see the metrics that they're looking for immediately, and they pull the plug on it. And so I think, you know, that's a huge reason that a lot of these corporations are failing because they're really not willing to take the big risk.
Actually, can I go back to a point Adam made? Because I think it's actually a pretty important one, which is the empowering people within the organization to make decisions. A lot of our organizational structures kind of came from industrial engineering mindsets where a command and control structure actually made a ton of sense, because what you're actually doing is moving people and pieces into a place to generate a consistent output. But we now live in a world where there's so much information, companies operate at global scale, that it's impossible for any one person to know everything that's happening in an organization. There's CEOs out there that don't even know all the products their companies are making. And so as a result, they really have to enable smart nodes in the company, if you will, with these centers of decision-making and excellence to take advantage of the information that they have, right? You can't go full command and control. And so there's this conflict between the way large companies have traditionally been organized, which, as Adam said, was for efficiency sake and structure and all these things, with the reality of the capabilities and the access to information and the ability to create rapidly that we have today. Those two things are at this tension point, and a lot of times they conflict.
So I think that leads into kind of a really important question that I think a lot of us are struggling with. So you have the situation where you do require some trust. Maybe you require a distribution of ownership and responsibility and decision-making. So ultimately, how do you measure the success of an innovation effort? How do you know when it is succeeding, you should continue moving forward and have faith, versus this isn't working, it's time to basically scrap it and move on to something else? I don't know if you want to continue, Luke, with kind of that train of thought.
Sure. Well, I think the models that I've seen that are successful do a number of them at the same time, right? You just basically run a couple small initiatives that are, I think Kate sort of mentioned this with the timeline. They went through 3 iterations of it, right? That got pretty fully built until they came up with one that they were feeling good about. You see that very frequently, in that you make a number of small bets as opposed to a single large bet on the one thing, because that puts way too much pressure on the one thing. And, Adam, now going over to Rick Greylock, entering the VC world, you see all these startup models, the super angels, the VCs, the seed stage, whatever you want to call that phenomenon, of people in the venture community making lots and lots of small bets in many places. Very similar to how a large organization that generally has a successful innovation program works.
Right.
To use kind of the cliche, and who knows if this is exactly true or not, but you know, it's sort of common legend that Apple generally runs 10 prototypes of any new product that they're putting out there. And Steve goes and kills the ones that he doesn't like.
Right. So Adam, I guess you're getting ready to wear a new hat and kind of sitting on the other side of the table and looking at a lot of examples of innovation in these startups. And how are you going to be looking at that and saying, yes, this is succeeding, we should continue to invest in this versus not?
Well, I think to be honest, I think that problem is less mysterious than it seems. I think that, you know, we've learned a lot in the last few years about what makes consumer software really tick and engage with people. And it's amazing how fast you can get ideas out there and find out what's resonating, what's working, and what's not working. So to be honest, I think that that's part of the problem is less difficult. What I like that Luke mentioned here is going back to that culture idea about innovation, we all take for granted in Silicon Valley the fact that we have this umbrella culture around risk and innovation that allows all those startups to participate, right? It allows them to recruit great engineers and great designers and great people who, frankly, in almost any other area of the world would get routed into higher value, using the air quotes, positions that would be safer but wouldn't yield the same type of results. I think the challenge for executives in companies and great leaders, whether that's a product leader, a design leader, a CEO, is one thing that venture capitalists don't have to do is create that ongoing culture. We live it, we breathe it in Silicon Valley. I think when you lead a company, whether you're Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, whether you're a Jeff Weiner at LinkedIn, you have to find a way to create that culture in an organization if you want it to be sustainable. I'm going to paraphrase a little bit of Reed here, because usually that's safe, but you know, Reed's a big believer that there are three types of risks, right? There's mortal risk, right? If you get this wrong, it's done. Like, the company's over. You don't get to play round two. There's painful risk, which is it's going to hurt if this isn't the right thing, but it won't kill us. And then there's embarrassment risk, where all you have to do is just admit that, oh, it didn't work. What did we learn from it? Go a different direction. You're not perfect. And what happens time and time again is that people don't take enough painful risks, and they spend all their time worrying about embarrassment risks. When the reality is that as companies, as innovators, our whole reason to build new products, to build new companies, is to take some of those risks, because behind some of those doors are things that we haven't even thought of, ecosystems that haven't even existed yet. The great thing about startups, which is hard to replicate in a company, is that they live with mortal risks. Right, they don't have money coming in. Even if they have funding, they make bet the company, bet your dinner decisions all the time. So there's a purity to the startup experience which familiarizes entrepreneurs with what it means to really make bets. And the sad fact is that the larger organization gets, the more and more they tilt towards fearing embarrassment risks and not taking painful risks, because they don't even remember what mortal risks feel like.
So I'd like to switch a little bit here and take one of the questions that's coming in from the people who are attending. I think it's a good question. And Kate, I'm going to direct this at you. So, you know, in your experience, because I'm sure you've been there where you're presenting to the exec team, what approaches do work when you're standing in front of Mark Zuckerberg trying to present a innovative idea and get his approval?
Well, so Mark is a unique case where I have a unique experience where many times I think I'm presenting him something that's pretty innovative and out there, and he'll tell me it's not enough. So he's pretty easy to present that kind of stuff. But I think so even in those conversations, I think you have to boil down whatever that innovation is that you're going to take. What is at the core of it? You know, is it speed? For instance, with our messages product last year, we decided that, you know, most messaging systems were based on email, which was based on snail mail with these, you know, subject lines and address books and things like that. And we thought it could be much more streamlined. So our whole core of innovation on messages was something that was going to be streamlined and social. So make sure that when you go into your executive, you tell them exactly where you're going to be pushing the boundaries, and you really, really focus on that. Secondly, make it as immersive as an experience as possible. When we were experimenting with timeline, even when we didn't have prototypes built that he could play with, we made a lot of physical things. We showed him things like scrapbooks, memory boxes, all those kinds of things that he could see and touch and have discussions around. that really let him immerse himself in where our ideas were coming from. So I think that's pretty important. Go back to your core value, where you're trying to innovate, why, what's your core belief and why you think you can do something different, and then make it as immersive as possible. And bring them in early and often, and also let them know that you're going to be throwing away a lot of work, and you know you're taking a risk, and you really want them to participate with you and get excited with you and let them bring their ideas to the table as well. If you just come in with kind of a very formal presentation of something that's 6 months old that can't be really iterated on, I think you're going to set yourself up for failure. Because many times innovative ideas do look messy to the point of the rest of the panelists.
I think you've made a really fantastic point that I want to kind of reiterate around it with the immersive experience. And it's two of the most powerful tools that I think you can bring to the table. One is having a designer, and the other is having a prototyper. It's two of the most important hires that you can make at any company. And it's one of the things that I learned early at eBay and I replicated when I was at Yahoo is having a dedicated prototyping team. Because I found that when you go in front of the executives, it's what looks real wins the day. Somebody comes in with a PowerPoint deck and, you know, a lot of words and a lot of metrics, people's eyes glaze over. When we came in with working code that was well designed and it was a beautiful product and it gave kind of the experience. This is what this product is going to be. Here's what you're going to get. And certainly you need to back it up with some realistic numbers and projections of what's going to happen. But it was amazing, the power of that prototype. And I think it's something that everybody can take away from this is get yourself a designer, get yourself a rapid prototyper. Anytime you're going to be presenting to an executive team, build something, get it in front of them.
And one thing I would add to that, Larry, having run a team of designers and prototypers for a couple years over at Yahoo, I absolutely agree with you that you can get the win from the executives a lot more effectively when you have something visceral and real that you can work with. But within a large organization, you also need to sort of set the groundwork with where that stuff is going to end up living.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing to have an innovative idea, bring it up and get executive approval. It's a whole nother thing to actually get it into the organization and get it out the door. And I think that becomes the harder part. So as Kate was saying, you know, including the executives early and ongoing in what you're doing, actually involving the people who these ideas might touch often and early, even though it takes a little bit longer, it's generally a good idea because then it just doesn't come down from them on high,
right?
Or come down at them as a surprise, right? Instead, they're part of the process and they can continue and then come in and start working with you to go from that prototype stage to the real thing.
We've actually moved away from having a standalone prototyping team to actually have the engineers who are going to be working in this space do participate in prototyping themselves. There's opportunities to innovate, not just in design, but in code as well. And they can really participate and add quite a bit to the process by not, again, having breaking down this kind of standalone model and having everyone on the team participate. And it works out really well.
There's three roles there, and Luke and Kate both hit on this, that kind of make this work, right? This basic founding team, right? Designers have a superpower. Like, I think all roles in companies have superpowers. Designers have a superpower of visualization. The truth is, a lot of people can't understand something until they see it. Designers have this power to see things that don't exist yet. And when they share that power, it can go an amazing distance with executives and other folks who don't have that same power. An engineer who's motivated, who understands what's now technically possible and not possible, things that are different than a few years before, can really push the envelope in terms of what you can deliver. And then what I'll call a product manager, or what you want to call an entrepreneur or a business person, however you want to phrase it, that person who finds a home who will do the 100 things to not just win that executive meeting, but get it all the way out the door and complete the cycle of getting it out to customers. Sometimes you find all three of those roles filled by one exceptional person. But more often than not, what I've seen as companies scale is you get that group of people together, and it changes the dynamic from just inspiration, which a designer can do, from just technical amazement, which is what engineers can do, and just kind of, we can shift this, we can make a difference, we can disrupt an entire industry, which is what great product managers do, you get the three of them working together, they push each other and they push the company to actually change the dynamic. I saw one of these things happen at LinkedIn, where amazing new backend technology built on Hadoop, et cetera, allowed them to generate just an understanding of what had happened to you over an entire long time period, an entire year. It ended up turning into initially an email, this year in review email, which not only was one of the most successful things for the company, but actually, you know, for those who are into metrics, was actually measured in clicks per email rather than click through rate, because it was that interesting. But that came because we had a passionate engineer who understood what modern systems would let you do, even with complicated graph backends. It had a passionate designer who knew how to capture the human element of wanting to engage with this thing. And there was a business person there who saw the opening for that innovation to actually change the dynamic of how LinkedIn engaged with its audience. And when that happens, it's amazing to see.
So Adam, Gary Tan, who is over one of the co-founders of Postgres, calls those three roles hacker, hustler, and designer.
Exactly. I mean, there are rare individuals out there, and when you meet them, you know it. It really is an impressive thing. I happen to be very biased towards the fact that there are people who have those roles, but even those people have trouble scaling at some point, and they find a need to replicate parts of themselves. And how do you replicate that magic? And a lot of the work that I did at LinkedIn, to be honest, that I'm most proud of, was encouraging people just work with each other, right? That incredible passionate engineer who understood what Node.js could do, and marrying that with that designer who was just eager to make interfaces that went beyond what we've seen in the mobile web in the last year. You pull those people together and you give them a halo where they can actually execute. It's more than just executive approval. Granted, the executive pitch will go well when you get those folks together, but it's beyond that. It's how do you get them to market and really change the dynamic of the business so that it becomes obvious to everyone else that that was the right direction all along. Like, that's the magic of innovation, is that once it happens, everyone looks back with 2020 hindsight and can't imagine it going any other way.
So it sounds like you guys are kind of answering another question that we said we would talk about, but who is the person that is best positioned to drive innovation? And from what I'm hearing, it's no single individual, and it's actually no single role. It doesn't sound like what you're saying is that innovation springs initially and only from design or from the technology partner or from the hustler. It sounds like you're saying we need to be a lot more flexible and mutable about how this is structured and who ends up actually kind of inspiring and driving this.
Yeah, and yeah. Adam, sometimes it's more than one person that plays more than one of those roles.
Yeah, well, I've been fortunate enough in my career to touch each of those roles, right? You know, the design side, I was an engineer at Apple, and then, of course, I spent a lot of the last decade on the product side, or the hustler side. But honestly, I think that there is a leadership component here. I would not confuse Facebook's willingness to take risks, its passion for thinking big, for changing really the world of how people interact with software, with anything less than having absolute top-level leadership. I mean, founding teams, CEOs, top executives, who send a tone every day, every hour, that's what they're there to do. And so, you know, I think everyone in the company, some of our best hackers at LinkedIn weren't in the technology organization at all. They were on the sales and marketing side, had a passion for a customer problem, an ability with code, and came up with solutions that we didn't even think of. So I think anyone can innovate, but that only exists when the absolute company at the top level rewards that behavior. And let's not forget, I'm a parent. I know that some of the other folks on the panel are parents too. Being a parent is a little, it adds a lot of humility around the fact that what you do is so much more important than what you say. A lot of executives talk, a lot of leaders talk to innovation, but in their behaviors, who they promote, who gets attention, what products they call out, say more than anything about what they actually reward at that company. And I think what you're seeing in current companies is the ones where the leadership really reward innovation, and not just the end result, but the entire messy process of it, are the ones that see those best results. I think it's a top-level culture thing.
I do too. Even just to the small point of, like, anybody can participate, when we were trying to set up some of these teams that are building products, some of the rooms got to be too small. People like to get together in war rooms. You need to be flexible in how you work. And the facilities guys, they knew they didn't have to ask permission to do anything. They actually cut down a wall over a weekend and built a loft, right, to make sure the team had what they needed. And that to me says that, like, everybody in the office felt that they had the trust to do whatever they had to do to get things done at the end of the day. So whether it's an admin doing space planning, we've even had hack days where finance people and HR people come and stay up all night to relook at their processes and how they communicate with one another. It really is something that is can't just be left to the designers, the engineers. It's actually quite fun when everybody gets involved.
So I'm going to kind of go back to an earlier question, and because I want to leave a little bit of time at the end, I think, to wrap up on some of the topics and concepts that you're raising right now. But I think we're all familiar with a lot of innovation or invention myths, and it's unfortunate, but I think I continue to see them being perpetuated at a lot of the companies that we worked at. What are some of your kind of favorite myths and ones that you've seen that have actually hurt companies because they believe in them? How about you, Kate?
Okay, good question. I'm just trying to look. I think
I'm gonna put one out there as you guys are thinking about this because it's kind of one that has personally bothered me over the years. And I think there's one that you have to create a completely separate group to be responsible for innovation. And I've seen it, you know, actually done at some of the companies that I've been at. And it was a completely separate team in a completely separate building, and they had no boundaries and they had no goals, but they were just chartered with being innovative. And I think what I saw happen is that they created a lot of interesting things, but nothing that really could be fed back into the organization or to any of the products in a successful way. I think, Luke, you talked about that earlier. And I think what I've also seen when you do that is it creates a lot of resentment in the rest of the organization, because you're supposed to keep the product running and continue to be successful with it and drive revenue. We'll let this other team innovate for you and bring back great ideas to make your product more innovative. And I've seen that happen time and again at many companies, and I think it's a major failure.
But at the same time, like a almost parallel process, which I actually have seen work, and Adam, you and I kicked off a pretty big project at eBay like this, where a team literally gets locked away to work on something different and new for the purpose of keeping them away from the stuff that could bog them down in the existing organization. And I you can chime in, Adam, how effective you thought this was or not, but the project was this eBay Express thing, which is essentially a new commerce experience built on top of eBay. And I have a couple other examples from other companies where there's something new and different that isn't tied to necessarily the way things have been running, where an executive decision is made to quadrant this off for a little bit, mm-hmm. kind of like putting a baby on its own so it doesn't get, I don't know, it's a crappy metaphor.
No, but the original Macintosh team was like that, right? They were mm-hmm. completely separate from the organization. I think I agree with you. That works for a new product or a new product line. Where I get concerned is when that team is chartered with innovation for the rest of the company.
Yeah, I think it's funny, Luke. You mentioned this in the very first question, but I think that a myth that you're hitting on right there, the way I would phrase it is that a lot of people like to talk, and it's been fashionable for more than a decade to talk about innovation and disruption and, you know, the innovator's dilemma and that sort of thing. But I do think there's this myth that somehow there's a magic solution of disruption that, to your point, isn't painful, right? You know, people seem to feel like there's some magic way where you can lock that group away in a room, but at their heart, you're going to come up with this radically new business, this radically new product, this radically new direction and even vision for the company. And then somehow that won't hurt when you have to explain to thousands of people that you're changing direction or explain to a huge number of investors that actually the dollar signs might go the wrong way for a short period of time. You know, I look at what's going on with Netflix right now, and I'm not an expert on Netflix, although I'm a fan of a lot of the things that they do. And what I see there is a company that is taking incredibly, to my categorization of risk, incredibly painful risks because they believe that there's a massive disruption coming to their business and industry, and they are taking all that.
It's not mortal.
But not, well, potentially. I mean, you know, it's, you know, the funny thing about
mortal.
Painful risks, Yeah. And so I think that the biggest myth that I see at a lot of large companies is somehow that disruption isn't massively painful when it's at that scale. And you know, the good news for companies like Facebook or LinkedIn and that sort of thing is on the first rapid growth curve that you're riding up, which sometimes can last 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, you rarely have to deal with that kind of disruption. But the best tech companies, I think, now have a little bit more sophistication about the fact that what does disruption really look like? And more importantly, what does it feel like? Like, what it should feel like is, wow, if we do that, we would lose this money over here, or these metrics over there, or this whole product line goes away. And I think it takes a special type of fortitude and belief in how these things play out in the long term to take that leap towards an innovation. And so, yeah, if you lock a team away, or to your point, you know, lock a special team on innovation, there's no chance that's going to work, right? Because that team can't make that a company decision. That has to be a leadership thing.
Kate, any favorite myths come up while you're listening to this?
A lot of them are very similar to the other ones. I think there was the question, I think, that came up that I saw written, like, if you don't have a Steve Jobs, can you innovate? I think Adam's point, innovation isn't always beautiful. It isn't always just one genius moment that comes from one person. And innovation doesn't just happen with one team. I think it does start from a set of values that everyone shares and embraces. But it is a struggle. I mean, I'm imagining, you know, if there's a designer on the line that works at a big company and they're thinking, oh, innovation has to start with changing my corporate values tomorrow. Like, how am I going to go do that? Like, that is a real challenge. So I think there's a balance between the locked away team and those sweeping corporate values. I think you can start it with any project that you're on, but be it how you sit, how you communicate, how you prototype, and then, you know, communicate and share from that. I think change rarely takes place at a corporate level from somebody putting up a PowerPoint and saying, this is how we're going to do things moving forward. It most often takes place from, you know, one group of people doing something small that's interesting, and then you let it grow as people start to replicate it. So I would say to the people that are listening right now, like, don't feel down if you don't feel like you can change your corporate values tomorrow. You get started with a small group of people that can get started with you and on a real problem, and then share from there.
Yeah, that actually is another myth that I've actually seen very troubling to me. And the reason it's troubling is it's not a myth about executives. It's a myth that actually individual designers and engineers can believe, which is they believe that if they can't convince a senior executive to back their idea, if they don't get funding, that somehow they can't influence the future, that they can't innovate. And this gets back to the team things. You know, a lot of great athletic teams do amazing things, or a lot of athletes are inspired not by their coach, but by their competition, by their teammates, by the folks they work with. We have this amazing power to inspire the other folks we work with. And when I say inspire, I don't just mean all rosy, positive, you know, we can take this hill. I also mean when you do great work, when you push it to the next level, the people around you notice, and it pushes them to do their best work. That's why these teams can produce so much more than any random individual, because that designer imagines things that are possible, and great engineers want to make it possible. Engineers come up with ideas of things that they can do, and designers say, I had no idea that was even possible. Imagine this that we could do with it. And you get that back and forth. So the biggest myth that I've seen on the individual level is one which says, unless I get backing, it's not even worth trying. And so many great innovations, if you go back to the very beginning, you have one or two people there late at night who are just inspiring each other to push a little harder. And that's a very hard thing for executives to hear and individuals to hear, because that's not a process thing. Once again, that's a culture.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go ahead, Luke.
I got a couple myths. Should we still talk about them? Or no?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Sure. So one thing is this idea of the miscategorization of what people consider the minimum viable product. Mm-hmm. And what I've seen this come to mean in lots of organizations is just ship a lot of stuff that's incomplete or kind of crap. And I think the way it actually ought to be interpreted is try to do less stuff, but do it well, right? It doesn't mean just start throwing a gazillion things against the wall. on a, you do that yourself when you go through the process, but when you actually have a company with lots of users out there with an existing business model, so on and so forth, don't just throw things out that are, you know, are, how shall I say, and this is a fine line, right? I just see a lot of people get lost in this minimal viable product without understanding there's still an element of quality and thought attached to it.
Right.
And one of the outcomes of that sort of process is that you end up in a situation when you emphasize lots of small, iterative, constant things, that sometimes you lose the big picture. And you see this just to call, you know, Amazon is a very innovative company, and they launch new products all the time on their product pages. But you go to their product pages now, and the sense of coherency, of prioritization, of focus is gone because they have just about every single feature in the world thrown on that page. And I see this happening in other companies who remain nameless, right? But there's a balance there between throwing lots and lots and lots of ideas on the thing and actually having a coherent structure around vetting those or some level of acceptance of those, so on and so forth.
So I think you're...
And I don't have answers for that. I'm just sort of throwing that out there, stuff you start to see in the market.
So I think what you guys are have been saying is really touching on a couple of questions and kind of blending them together. And it's really around this concept of, should there be a more formal organizational process for innovation, or should it be something that's a lot more freeform that you're basically leaving up to the individuals in the organization and essentially enabling, but you're not really going to have a formal process around it. And I've seen this go to the extremes where there is a very dedicated process and you have a specific, you know, week within every quarter that's dedicated to innovation and kind of creating the pipeline. You have all these brainstorming meetings and so forth, towards something that's more in the middle, where you look at when Google used to have dedicated time for people to do their innovation projects. And so they didn't tell them what to do or how to do it, but they did make sure that they had time to dedicate to doing it. And then, you know, to the far extreme, just kind of hoping, you know, you hire smart people, you have enabling technology, and you're certainly hoping they're going to create things. And it's a much more kind of freeform, chaotic process. So I'm curious what your points of view are on that and where you fall on that scale.
Well, you know, I have a strong point of view on this one. I actually think it takes both. The thing that's been most fascinating to me about social software in general has been how much we've had to relearn about how social contracts work, how societies come together, what happens when human beings interact and come together. Because you see it on all the social networks. There are unwritten rules about how people interact with each other that aren't requirements of the technology. But, you know, the status box on Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook are largely the same technically. But what people choose to do with it, what they find acceptable and unacceptable, are unwritten and have to do with the social interactions that people have. Companies are the same way. If you have an organic social contract around innovation, but there's no process to bring it up, it's kind of like having a society with no law, right? Largely, you may get the right behavior, but you'll be surprised at how a few bad actors or a few bad interactions can keep that unwritten law from really coming together and building the culture you want. The best cultures have that mix of a legal system, right? And in a company, this would be processes. Like, how do we get things done? What's the tone? What do we value? That has to be formal in some regards. At LinkedIn, the fact that Jeff said, look, every Friday once a month, I do not want you working on your day-to-day work. I want you working on something different and new. It's not about that time. The truth is innovation happens in late nights and weekends anyway. It's not just on that one day. But it sets a tone that is that important. On the flip side is if you have a process like that, but you don't back it up with those little actions, like culture, what people say and do every hour and every day, the process won't get you there. So I really am a big believer that it isn't one or the other. You have to have both to make it work. And the truth is, from a leadership perspective, it's a tricky thing to figure out how to push the culture and how to push the process in a way where one doesn't try to dominate the other as a company grows.
Kate, what are your thoughts on this?
I just wrote down that it seems like a strict innovation process seems a bit like an oxymoron, but just one thought. I side very much with Adam. I think it takes a blend of one, embracing it culturally, and two, setting aside some type of process. I mean, at least with like our design team, it's not a strict process, but we encourage broad and rapid sweeping iteration at the beginning of any project. We always make sure people have lots of freedom at the beginning of a project. Not that you can't have it at the end, but it's most comfortable at the beginning. So all of our designers understand that, and they work quite a bit on that. We also have our hack days, but out of hack days can come innovation on how to hack. We know that every couple months we actually do three-day hack days where people actually like camp out and sleep, where they form into different kinds of teams, because we just saw that coming out of our 24-hour hack days. So it's like always being open to something new and organic coming out, innovations coming out of your innovative process.
So I want to make sure we leave a little bit of time and start hitting some of the questions that I see coming in. I think some are very related to some of the questions that we said we addressed, and some are a little bit different. I think there's a good question here, and Adam, you've been talking a lot about culture, but what specifically have you all done to try to change or influence the culture of the organizations that you've worked in to help foster innovation? And you know, there are prior things you tried that failed miserably, and we'd love to hear about those as well. How about you, Luke?
Sure. Well, I can speak to my most recent experience in a startup. The first thing Sam and I did, who was my technical co-founder there, we built an infrastructure that allowed us to move extremely quickly with how we built stuff. So just as a comparison point, when I was at Yahoo, it would take, you know, in orders of many, many months to go ship a change to something like registration. And we set out up front to create a system where that would take hours.
Hmm.
And so, I mean, this was very much a tactical thing, right? Build an infrastructure, build a coding platform that allows the two of us to ship code quickly. And I think something like that is a step that you can take towards getting the kind of rapid iteration Kate was talking about that they have in the beginning of their products during their hack days and where have you.
I think there's a couple of things, you know, that I think is a great question. And I think, you know, this also touches a bit on a lot of what Adam has been saying, too. Is that you have to kind of walk the walk. If you're saying that you want an innovative organization and you want to support this culture of innovation, are you truly rewarding it? And I think, you know, there's a couple of things that when I was at Yahoo that I did to try to really drive this. And one is who you hire. You know, are you hiring a diverse set of individuals who, and to be honest about this, that make you uncomfortable? Are you hiring people who are different from the rest of the organization that are really going to drive change? You know, just smart people, but they're a little bit crazy and they make you a little bit uncomfortable, and they should. And I think kind of related to that, are you rewarding that? You know, when it comes around to the annual review process and looking at promotions and raises, who are the people that are being rewarded? You know, is it the folks who basically be kind of continuing the same and supporting the norm and kind of driving day-to-day operations? I mean, it's not like that isn't necessary, but are you also rewarding people who took risks, you know, and potentially failed, but you learned from it? And so I think the rest of the organization has to see that you hire and you reward people who do things that are a little bit different. They take risks. They're not afraid of failing, but they're intelligent and they learn from it.
Yeah, and Larry, one thing to add to that, on the group I had at Yahoo, I made a point of when I brought people in to make sure that they were actually noticeably different from the other people on the team. So we would hire like a physical product designer, a back-end engineer, a front-end engineer, just people who have a deep area within something very different from everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But then they have, if you imagine this sort of T-shaped person, they have these connector rods where they can work with other people. So they have basic like design skills, right? Or they have basic web product management type skills that allow them to connect with people that have different areas of deep expertise.
So I know, Adam, that you and Kate as well, you both have led teams, and you know, you're responsible for the hiring and the firing, as well as kind of the reward system you put in place. What did you do as managers of those organizations to support this innovation effort?
I mean, there's one kind of value that I tell a lot of the people on the team after they're hired. I like to see if they're the type of people that are going to ask permission or ask for forgiveness, and I'd rather have them ask forgiveness. You know, when it comes to cultural change, it just starts with one or two people. I think I'd encourage everybody who's like listening today, like, what's the one step you could take tomorrow? And would you, what's your personal risk? Like, what would you really get in trouble for tomorrow if you want to go sit next to an engineer because you think you guys could do something more innovative and be faster in your process? Would you really get in trouble for going and doing that? So I often come in the morning and like our space will look different, or, you know, the dashboard I was used to yesterday for the design team is completely changed. And I think it's just making sure that you're talking to people in your interview process that might not always give you what you think is the right answer, but it's people that really can look at things in a much different way. But again, that aren't disruptive with it. I think if you're bringing in people that are different, they also have to be collaborative and they have to be willing to share what they know, encourage others, and be strong collaborators and strong socially with the team.
You know, it's amazing how universal that is. How, you know, everyone feels like they sound smart when they come up with the reasons why something won't work. I actually joke about this now that I'm moving into venture capital, but, you know, venture capitalists, especially new ones, it's almost as if they feel like they're paid to figure out all the reasons it can't work. And the reality is, in the short term, you sound really smart for coming up with reasons to say no. In the long term, you only seem smart for the times you said yes. And that's not just a venture thing. That's not just a design thing, engineering thing. Is a culture thing. I mean, the truth is I've tried too many things around innovation that haven't worked to list them all now. I think that's par for the course. I mean, there was a little comment here about agitators, but the truth is, you know, the number of ideas that I would walk around at eBay and LinkedIn pushing around, and it's always that mix of the right idea with the right person with the right time. And more often than not, it doesn't come together because they're too afraid or they're too busy or they just haven't gotten over that hump. But the thing I'm most proud of at LinkedIn in terms of driving this process forward and things that, you know, set up is getting a culture where people, that reward, believe it or not, wasn't money. There weren't checks. There weren't even promotions. Although there's a high correlation between the people who did amazing things and in the long term got promoted. That's where just having senior leadership present. I mean, I think the fact that Zuck participates in so many Facebook hack days matters. I think the fact that at LinkedIn that Jeff or Reed or Kevin or David Henke actually will sit down there and you work, as a company gets bigger, we all take for granted that ability to influence folks and inspire them. But very small signals can set up a system where people see amazing things one month and then next month they say, you know what, that's going to be me. I can do that. I want to do that. I have to do that. So I'm most proud of the cultural elements around innovation. I think that that's, and it took a long time. I remember that first hack day at the end of 2007. It was purely because we were designing a new space and we wanted new applications to put up on plasma screens that we had hung on the wall. And people took the holiday break to just write stuff up to put on the screen. No one would have guessed then that at this point you'd have hundreds of new applications, hundreds of engineers participating every month doing this stuff. It takes time to build these things out.
And I'd like to make, I think, one final point, you know, before we wrap up here. I saw a good question come in the chat window, is that we are focusing, I think, a lot on products here. We're talking a lot about web-based products and software. But the reality is, if you look at some of the most successful innovations in the market, they weren't a single innovation along a single dimension. You know, I talk a lot about compound innovation models, and that is looking at every aspect of what it takes to ideate, develop, create, and deliver a product to the market. So I think one of the things that is important for you to do as a leader within your organization is, how are you rewarding innovation along every single dimension? You know, are you rewarding the people who make the processes internal that much more efficient, better? You know, the guy who invented a bug tracking system that makes things better. You know, we had that at several of the companies I worked at, where some of the best innovations and really exciting things were happening internally that were never shipped to a customer, but it made it easier for all of us to work together. I mean, Luke described an example of this. So I think, you know, let's not get too fixated on innovation around just a specific product and we're all envisioning the iPhone or whatever. I think innovation can occur along so many different dimensions when you look at the people, the way you structure, the way you reward, the processes that you have. And I think you have to hire the right people and incent the right behavior and reward everyone who's helping every single aspect of this. So I know we're just about out of time here. I just want to thank the panelists. Thank you, Luke, Kate, and Adam. This has been a really good discussion. Great questions that came in from the audience as well. And I hope you learned a little bit of something today. Thanks.
Thanks, Larry.
Yeah, thanks, Larry.